well in your beds.
Because if this thing comes true, there ain't gonna be any more.
It's an elevator. Somebody sent those deads up here to get us. Now, there's no controls inside, but there's maintenance overrides in there. I think I can get it to go down.
That you couldn't help your little friend. That little girl. What was her name again? Rue? Yeah, well, we killed her. And now, we're gonna kill you.
But you don't understand. You don't know. This place isn't what we thought it was. They aren't what we thought they were. I was wrong. We were so wrong. We must leave.
Hello, welcome once again to Doc Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A. And with me is the podcast fool from Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I am well.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I had one of those where I did four episodes in one week when I helped Leo and a few. It was just crazy. It's terrible. But as long as it's not all the time, I've noticed. It's
okay. Yeah.
And Mike, too. Mike had that problem once.
Yeah, I think I did two with Leo, and then I don't remember if we were doing Game of Thrones or Westworld and the regular Dark Discussions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't sustain four, but I'm doing four this week.
Right. Yeah, and then we had a couple where we did an interview. Me and Mike did an interview. We did the interview for Alone, and then we did Lovecraft Country, and then we did the regular episode. Yeah, so and yeah, that was a crazy week too. But anyway, we have other co-hosts here, and that's from New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you, sir?
I am tired, Phil. How are you?
Same. Thank God I'm taking off all of Thanksgiving week from work. So that will be good. And in the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Hi, everyone. This is Dave here.
Dave, how are you, sir?
I'm all right. Looking forward to the weekend.
Yeah, very well. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I am looking forward to the weekend as well. Totally.
Indeed. So for folks who are curious, one of our listeners has requested this, and her name's Pam. She has asked us to give us the date that we record, because sometimes these episodes don't come out the following week. And this is November 19th, 2020. We are recording this episode for folks who are curious. So let's see. For folks who have just found us, we are darkdiscussions.com, which is one of the podcasts on the Dark Discussions Network. The Dark Discussions Network is, as I just stated, darkdiscussions.com. This is the Dark Discussions podcast, named after the network. But there's like 30 other podcasts on the network, as well as all your news, genre news, and whatnot that you can find on the website. We have a email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where you can join in the discussion, Twitter account, Dark Discussion 1, and pretty much that's about it. But we do have some other stuff on the website, Eric.
Yes, we do. We have some articles that you can go check out. I honestly, Phil, have not been in that section since you redesigned the site. Is the original content still up, or is that just links to outside articles at this point?
Nope. There's a whole – all the articles are live on the website. There was a couple that were released today, including some release notices, like the Wonder Woman being HBO Max bound on Christmas Day. So there's all a bunch of news there and articles. Yep.
Okay. And then you can also find a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially support your online artists like podcasters. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate, I've done that at least half a dozen times. For every $5 a month you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do a show on. We take all the choices from our patrons, and we choose one at random on a quarterly basis to do a show about. So producing this show is not free. We have to pay for things like server hosting and websites and equipment and movie rentals and so on and so forth. So if you'd like to help support us, that's how you can do it. We'd appreciate if you do. So you're going to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or go to darkdiscussions.com and you can find a link to the Patreon account on every page.
Yep, absolutely. And we just recorded Candyman. That episode is in the queue to be released. And we are doing Rocky Horror Picture Show shortly. We were thinking of doing it in December, but December is going to go by quick. So we may actually record it in January because of the end of year stuff that we usually do, including the Christmas movie episode, the New Year's Eve episode, as well as the best of the year episode. So,
well, and the good news is this year you could just take the last year's movies we're looking forward to and replay it, because none of them have been re-released.
Because that episode is dumb, just like I've been telling you guys for 5 years.
Yes, it is dumb to do it when you're expecting a pandemic to shut down all the movies in the country.
Yes, yes. And
that once a century.
Right, exactly. Once a century. That's literally 100 years later. Excellent. Absolutely. Good point, Mike. So, yeah, and then we'll have that episode probably, too, in early January. Now, I think the one big news was HBO and Warner Brothers, DC has notified everyone that Wonder Woman is now not going to be continued to be pushed back over and over and over. They've decided to release it the same day at theaters and VOD,
kind of
on HBO Max. So if you're a subscriber to HBO Max or your theaters are still open, you know, in whatever state you live in, you can watch Wonder Woman 1984. So that's kind of big news.
Right. There's a couple of things to this. First of all, they are releasing it earlier around the world in theaters. They're going to have to bite the bullet and lose the American market. But at this point, debt is piling up and creditors are calling. They want their money back. And so, you know, that's a thing. And also, HBO Max apparently hasn't done quite as well as they might have hoped, and so this is going to maybe spur some people to sign up, so I think they're hoping to make some money that way. It will be available on HBO Max for a month, they said. So for 30 days or so, give or take, it will be available on HBO Max with no additional costs, but you will have to be subscribing to HBO Max. I don't think it's going to be on like HBO, like regular HBO subscription. I don't know if there's still is. I don't even know if Go and Now even still exist.
I don't either. Yeah, I don't think they may even exist anymore. So, yeah, so I'll be watching that with my two daughters on Christmas Day. They'll be excited to see that. Yeah, and so hopefully it'll give some boost to HBO Max, because they do have some good programming there. And it is a pretty good VOD service. All right. I guess we can get into our topic tonight. If there's any other news or things we've been watching, we can mention at the end of the episode if we have time. So with that stated, Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight we're going to be discussing a Shudder movie released this year in 2020 called The Mortuary Collection.
This poor soul's journey has come to an end. From dust we started, to dust we return. Every corpse tells a story. It is our task to listen.
So these are all stories about how people died.
Some tales even I find too unsettling to recount.
She's dead!
You gotta get that body out of your apartment.
Keep your doors locked tonight and keep an eye out for crazies.
Oh, monster!
That's pretty cool.
Yes, it is, isn't it? no use running. Your story is just beginning.
That's right. The Mortuary Collection is a Shudder, quote-unquote, original. It was originally a Fantastic Fest release in 2019, you know, playing the festival circuits and whatnot, and it appears Shudder got the rights to it and released it in the U.S. of A. pretty much everywhere a month or two back. It got some buzz. It's actually getting some really good reviews by critics. It's by director Ryan Spindell, who actually, one of the segments was originally a 22-minute short film that he decided to create an entire movie around that he did it in 2018, and then he made it into a feature-length film. And that was the fourth story, and we'll discuss all the stories as well as the wraparound later. So the film has a number of actors that people may know from... I guess by face, but no one of note. There's no like huge big names except for maybe the guy that plays the mortician, and that is Montgomery Dark is the character's name, Clancy Brown, who was probably most known by me for the being the evil guard in Shawshank Redemption, but he was also in
Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sim caught the bug.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much the information we have. I don't get anything else really of note. The film was also written by Ryan Spindell. I think it was edited by him too. So he's the man of the evening. So I guess we can go around and how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So let's start with Abe, because Abe actually suggested this film to do as an episode. And Abe, did you see this film before we did the episode, or did you go in just suggest it and then watch it after the fact?
I suggested it. I hadn't seen it beforehand, but I heard, you know, I saw it was an anthology of, you know, scary stories and stuff like that, and I always enjoyed those. You know, I mean, they're varying quality, but I always found it fun because I've always liked scary stories until the dark. You know, Goosebumps and stuff like that. And I thought, you know, I saw the good reviews. And I was like thinking, okay, why not? You know, it seems promising. And so I watched it today just so I can keep every story fresh in my mind. It's a well shot film. I think it's definitely one of the better additions to Shudder's exclusives. It may not blow many people away, but I think it does some things pretty cool. Well, in terms of it, a few little, I wouldn't say completely original, but still well performed and visually strange stories. Some are played straightforward. Another one has, you know, it's like one's more of like a straight up morale. Well, most of them are morality tales, but the way that each of them play out in terms of tone is different. One's like straight up horror. Another is like gross out humor. The other is more of a dark tragedy. And then we get into more of the, how would you say, the surrounding piece, the kind of...
The wraparound story.
Wraparound story, thank you, of between some of our main characters, our more focal characters. I thought Clancy Brown was fantastic as the mortician. He was really, you know... He was really, I felt, the centerpiece of the whole thing. He was really enjoying his performance. I thought he's, you know, at first I couldn't really recognize him because of the makeup. I thought Caitlin Custer was pretty decent. I don't think she stole the show as much as Brown, but I think she, her banter back and forth was helped kind of at. Add some, you know, breathing room between each story. I didn't really see anyone who was particularly bad, though some I felt, you know, some of the number of these stories in terms of character actions and behavior had moments of you know, jumps in logic and, you know, require your suspension of disbelief. Some of the twists were not really that shocking. And, you know, I don't know if I would say this is the, so I wouldn't say this is the best horror anthology story I've seen. I think Trick or Treat or Creepshow would be my go-tos if I was recommending anything like that. But honestly, it's still pretty well-made. And it's going to be kind of interesting to kind of dive into each story you know, see what else we can dig up.
All right. Very good. Chrissy.
I heard about this because I am a Shudder subscriber, and it, you know, they did an ad, I don't know how many months or weeks ago, and I said, oh, awesome, and I added it to my list, and then it's just kind of been on my list waiting for me to check out, and then when you said, oh, we're doing it, I'm like, awesome, because I just haven't had a whole lot of time to just do movie watching on my own lately, unless it's for the podcast. So anyway, so that's how I heard about it. And, you know,
Chrissy, you're speaking for almost all of us, right? I mean, none of us have been able to watch films except for the podcast.
I know. I mean, it's just all been, I think, crazy for all five of us. But anyway, I did. I enjoyed this. I think my favorite story was probably the third one for obvious reasons, which it was very Poe-esque. Everybody drink. it really was. It was. And I'm definitely going to talk at length about that one. I thought it was kind of fun that they were, you know, it was the same actors that they were kind of using in the different segments. So it was almost like an American Horror Story where you could see, oh, yeah, that actor was in the last one playing that one. I mean, I love the atmosphere of it. I thought the opening was really evocative and it sucked me right in. I loved the whole idea of the world being made up of stories. And I loved some of the Lovecraftian elements that were pulled into this, some of the Poe elements that were pulled into this. The acting was a little bit inconsistent, but, you know, whatever. I mean, it's not something that I'm going to run around remembering. I think it's going to be, you know, it doesn't really have the impact that like a Creepshow had. However, I do think it was well written. I think it's one of the best wraparound stories I've ever seen, where things actually come back instead of, you know, even like in Creepshow or in some of these other anthology films, you get this very thin thread of a wraparound. And it's really like not even connective tissue. It's like connective toilet paper. Like it just doesn't hold together. And I really feel that the wraparound story was very solid in terms of like there was the appropriate echo of certain elements from the beginning. You know, it just it worked for me. So I would definitely say if you enjoy anthologies, yes, watch this one. At least check this one out.
All right. Very good. Mike.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with this. I tend to like anthology shows, although you know, there are some that just are not that good, you know, but there are ones I like. And like any anthology, there's hit and there's miss. But here I thought all the segments were solid. I'll go against Chrissy's grain and say the third one was probably the one I found the least engaging and it was probably the most predictable out of them. I will agree with her. I love the wraparound segment, partly because I loved what Clancy Brown did with his character. And I was thinking, well, here's the thing. If Shudder wants to get its own like sort of character icon going, if they want to do like movies like this every couple of years, they could do that. And they can like have the Mortuary Collection 1, 2, 3 and so forth. And they seemed like they were setting it up to have Clancy Brown and the other character as sort of their own, like a fictional universe version of Joe Bob and Darcy, maybe, you know, with the horror host and his assistant. It doesn't go that way. And I was out and I was kind of disappointed in that. And then I was really kind of enticed by how they did end it up. So it was a little weird. The segments are odd in that they start out with the first segment being a really, really, really short story, and they kind of get longer and a little more involved as they go along. And so I found it fun. There were fun moments in all of them. I love the fact that there's one character who runs for at least three stories. I don't know if he was in the fourth or not. Actually, the first. He was in story 2, 3, and 4. So little things like that I enjoyed. And there were some character actors I know I've recognized in there, but I'm not sure I could place them. But yeah, it was fun. And I think it was well directed. I thought the makeup was fantastic for the most part. The effects were pretty good. Yeah, I just had a lot of fun with it. To me, it's a high recommend.
All right. Very good. For me, I actually heard about this because a couple of folks on the Dark Discussions Network did podcasts on it. So there's a couple other podcasts on the network did podcasts on it. So I knew it existed because I was posting up their podcasts and they were titled around this film. And then Andrew Durand, one of our columnists, wrote a review for his column, Oh, the Horror, Movie Reviews on the Dark Discussions Network. So, again, I did read that review, and it seemed interesting. I'm not a huge anthology fan, as folks who listen to this podcast and have listened to many of our podcasts where we talk about anthology films, I'm not a big fan of them because they're usually a mixed bag, and a lot of times there's a lot of comedic ones in the mix, and I'm not really fond of different tonal shifts in movies, and that's probably the reason why I don't like anthologies that much. This one here, I would say, has five stories if we include the wraparound story, and I felt I enjoyed three of them and was okay on the fourth, and then the fifth I just didn't like at all. Not in the order that they appear, but just out of five stories. But I could see that the one that was made as a short and how well it was, and it probably bounced this guy's career. And it was probably my favorite. Actually, this was probably one of my favorite films of the entire year for horror, even though it was only a segment. But it was definitely a mixed bag. The wraparound story Chrissy mentioned is phenomenal for wraparound story, so it was a big thumbs up. I wouldn't call it better than some of the other recent anthology films I've seen in the past few years. Like I like the VHS films better, and again though, if you take certain segments, the four segment in this film is as good as anything, but as a whole film I like the VHS's better, and Dan Lynch's film Patient 9, I think it was called, was I liked better.
Patient 7,
that's it. Yeah, but generally it was a good film. I just was kind of not as into it in the middle area. And we'll discuss those stories as we go. But it's okay. Yeah, it's decent. It's has some really big hits and some not so much. Eric?
I think I'm going to be the odd man out here because I didn't really care for this film. I can't argue with anybody's comments about it being well made, because it is. But it was just like... it was like eating plain oatmeal. You know, it's okay. It's not going to make you throw up. But man, there's a whole lot better choices. So yeah, I was pretty bored through most of the movie. And then like the last 10 to 15 minutes were kind of interesting, but at that point I had checked out and didn't really care. So I guess this movie is just not for me. So yeah, I can't recommend it because I didn't really enjoy it, but apparently other people did, so that's cool.
I'll say it for you, Eric. Curse you, Abe Spitty. All right. All right. So Yeah, it's mixed around. All of us have different opinions. There's no unanimous, and there's no absolutely horrible or absolutely great. It's truly a mixed group of folks here. So, Eric, do we have any wiki?
Wiki. An eccentric mortician recounts several macabre and phantasmagorical tales that he's encountered in his distinguished career. I did not realize that word was in this wiki, and I'm very proud of myself for getting through it.
Bravo.
You did well.
You get a cookie.
Yes, the golden star. All right, so eventually we're going to get into spoilers because we, on Dark Discussions podcast, don't just review, we also critique and dissect the things in the movie, and we'll do that. But before we do that, I guess we can get into our non-spoilery opinions and things. So, yeah, let's start with, all right, if we have the wraparound story and then story 1, 2, 3, and 4, Mike, what was your favorite out of the five?
Honestly, I really did like the wraparound story quite a bit. Okay. I don't know if it's my favorite because it's hard because it's broken up, obviously, going by interstitial segments, and it's not really there so much to tell a story, even though it does. I just really enjoyed the interplay between Clancy Brown and the young actress. Clancy Brown under a very good makeup job for the most part, other than around the mouth, which is often where it betrays it. I thought it was fairly convincing. And like I said, I was disappointed in how it ended until we got to the final shot or so, and then I kind of switched around on it. But of the four of the main stories, three was at the bottom for me, although I didn't not enjoy it. I didn't think it was a bad segment. Let me think. I might have gotten a kick out of the second one the most. I really thought the actor in that was really solid, and I thought he was very charismatic. So it could have been that one. I also liked the first one because it was actually very short and very quick and very tentacly.
All right, very good. Abe, what was your favorite of Wraparound and the four? 1, 2, 3, 4.
I really did like the Wraparound. It was, I think, you know, not enough, you know, those anthology stories really solidify a really strong Wraparound tale. So that's on top. In terms of like the stories that beforehand, I do agree with Mike. I like the first one, man, because I was kind of hoping to be more of those kind of short little unsettling little tales and stuff like that. One on the bottom, I think in terms of some unsettling and poetic moments, or just kind of interesting little thing, visual imageries, I think I like three. For kind of the grim humor, though, two was kind of fun. And, you know, it was definitely the more, you know, one that was trying to go for that little extra shock value. The fourth segment, the babysitter murders, was, you know, it's only strong when it's connected to the wraparound. Overall, but they kind of had the highs and lows for me. But, you know, I was kind of hoping for, you know, more like the first story. You know, just weird, strange surprises and then moving on to the next.
All right. So what about you, Chrissy?
Okay. The one that I liked the best was the third one. And I think I found the imagery really disturbing. I liked what they did with a lot of it. Also, it worked on a couple of different levels, whereas the other three were sort of more playful. That one to me was really dark, like serious dark, like 34 Orchard kind of dark. And so I'm just going to go with that. That's probably a personal preference, that that's more of the type of stuff I like. The other stuff was much lighter to me. I would say the one I liked second best was number two, about, you know, the guy or whatever in the fraternity house. That one I liked. The third one down for me was the first one, because it was short and very economical. There was a lot going on in there that is told very little. It's just so economical. It's economical. It's very impressive. The Wrap is the fourth one down, and the one I liked the least was The Babysitter Murders. I was actually really bored. I was like, oh, man, okay, here we go. I'm going to stuff some envelopes now while this is going on, which is exactly what I did. But I do think that the fourth one is necessary because of its connection to The Wraparound. I thought The Mortician was a little bit cheesy. I'm trying not to be spoilery here. I almost thought that that character tried too hard a little bit to sort of be iconic, like in a Creepshow kind of way. But I also think that that's an homage to this particular style, these anthology types. You know, you sort of want that iconic person or detail to hold it all together.
There's always a face to these series. You know, you have the Reaper kind of creature from Creepshow. You have the Crypt Keeper. You have Sam from Trick or Treat. You need like some kind of face to kind of stand out.
I was gonna say, what this actually recalled to me was House of Mystery and House of Secrets from DC Comics, and which have each house had its own host. We're named Cain and Abel, conveniently enough. But so that actually what it specifically referred called back in my brain. But yeah, it's a thing.
All right.
Very good. So that's why I kind of let that go, because I recognize that that's just part of it. But yeah, I just thought it felt a little heavy to me. I thought the performance could have been a little bit lighter. And Mike, it's funny. I actually kind of disagree with you with the makeup job, because I took one look at that and went, oh God, that looks fake to me. But it could have been just what, you know, the TV that I was watching it on. So,
well, I've seen some really horrible old age makeup jobs. It can be really hard to do it well, because often they cake it on a little bit too much. And it's part of the problem is I know Clancy Brown well enough that I know that's not him. But I think that the worst part was probably around the mouth, because he doesn't have an old man's mouth, even with the teeth.
All right. Very good. Anything else, Gritty?
Nope. I'm good.
Okay.
For me, I was very happy that the fourth story existed, because the Babysitter Murder one, because if that one hadn't appeared in the film, I don't think I would have liked the film that much at all. I think that was the one that saved the movie for me. I do agree with Abe. The first story was really good, nice and quick and fun and interesting and somewhat German expressionist, how they set up the bathroom. So it was a really cool little segment. But then the second segment, I just didn't like at all. And then the third segment I liked, but it was just way too long. And it was predictable, as someone already mentioned, that, you know, you knew what was going to happen. And so by the time the fourth one came, I was like already beginning to check out, similar to Eric. But then the fourth segment, I felt was absolutely great. There was no message. It was just a really good 22-minute horror film, and I liked that one a lot, especially how they had a little horror film on the TV in the background, which was kind of cool too. And the Wraparound story was one of the better ones, as we discussed, though most Wraparound stories are fairly weak, I feel, anyway. So I would say the fourth, the Babysitter Murder was by far my favorite of the film. Eric, what about yourself?
I guess the wraparound and its tie-in with the four story. That's when it got interesting to me, is when we got the twist in the last story and its tie-in with the wraparound. The rest of it, whatever.
Yeah, I'm pretty much kind of like you, Eric. Though I could appreciate that 5-minute little first story. So it appears that everybody had different tastes of what they thought was the best story, which was kind of interesting.
Well, and that's the bane and the benefit of an anthology, right? Is that it has a little something for everybody, but rarely does it have everything that one person is looking for.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Yep. All right. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up before we get into the spoiler section?
So looking at the director on IMDb, it looks like Babysitter Murder was a short movie he made in 2016.
Yeah, that's what I mentioned.
He also has another one called, I think it's Kirkwood, which is the name of the asylum that is in this town. So he's sort of building his own little mini cinematic universe with this.
I think
no
it's
idea
Raven's
if the doctor
End.
Showed up in any of those.
Raven's End or something like that is the name of the town, I think. I forget.
Right. Raven's End is the name of the town. The college was Raven's End School of Technology. So REST, which I thought worked for a mortuary theme.
Yeah.
I did like, by the way, the kid on the bicycle was reminiscent of the wraparound segment of Creepshow 2.
Oh, yeah. The way he was dressed reminded me of Short Round.
Yeah. There is a kind of a timeless feel to this. I don't know if there was any like modern technology in the wraparound segment.
Yeah, it's supposed to take place in 1980 or 82, the wraparound segment, and then the other ones take place in the 60s or 70s or 50s.
Yeah, the first one is 50s, the second one is 60s, the third one is 70s, and the babysitter segment is 80s. That's what it's supposed to be.
Right.
And that's kind of what I got from.
And that makes sense, Christy, because the wraparound segment is 80s as well, and one of the lead characters in the wraparound is also the lead character in the 80s story, or the fourth story. So, and she's the same age in both.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of interesting, but to be honest with you, except for the clothes, I wouldn't have necessarily pegged the second segment as 60s. And I wouldn't have, you know, I actually, after the movie was over, I went and looked it up. And that's when they kind of were talking about that. I did like, are we spoiler free yet? Are we spoilers yet?
Not yet.
Okay, because I don't want to say anything yet then.
Okay. Well, let's just throw it up, the spoiler, so we'll talk about everything and anything. So you can continue now, Chrissy.
One of the things I liked in the opening of this, one detail I thought was nice, was the kid going up there with the camera. And of course, he leaves it behind. And then when he goes, the mortician tosses the camera on top of a box of a bunch of other kids' things. So that was one really great example of how this movie did with economy, as well as it did in the first story. This movie did a lot with conveying a lot of information to the viewer in images and body language that I was really impressed with. I mean, to me, when he throws that, you know, the camera on top of the box of stuff, it tells you that he's feared in town, that maybe the kids go up and knock on his door, probably on a dare. And also that this guy is maybe even a little lonely in his isolation. You know, he almost takes delight in luring these kids, or maybe even trying to get them to stay, you know, just to have someone to kind of talk to. There was a lot conveyed in that opening few minutes there.
Yeah. And we, you know, especially even during like the funeral scene, he is trying to bring comfort to his audience. And he seems to get kind of lost in trying to do so, which leaves a very awkward, taste in everyone's mouth. And even some people he tries to say goodbye to and stuff like that. Some avoid his gaze. Some don't say anything to him. You get a very sense he's a very isolated figure. Now we have the spoilers up there. It's taken to an even more literal sense, as we find out down the line, is he cannot leave.
Right, right. Yeah, I do think they did a decent development of Montgomery Dark is the character's name. Again, we don't know too much about him. If he's we figure out that he's some sort of supernatural being, but they do enough to show his eccentricities and whatnot throughout the wraparound story. I did notice that someone mentioned to me, I think it was in Andrew Duran's review on the Dark Discussions Network, the column he wrote, that Mortuary Dark kind of reminded him of the Tall Man from the Phantasm films. I don't know if anybody thought
that thought crossed my mind.
Yeah, I can kind of see it just a little.
He's an old guy in a black suit, balding, and he's tall, because Clancy Brown is tall. So yeah, I can kind of see that. What I liked about the character is there is a sense of a history to him. I did think it's interesting. Like in hindsight, I wonder, Sam or whatever the name of the character is, like when he tells her his name, she has a response, and then you just think it's kind of a. My first thought, of course, is, well, that's a little bit on the nose, isn't it? That Montgomery Dark for a guy who runs a funeral home. But I'm wondering now, given what we find out about her later, if, he admits to having done some horrible things in the past. And it makes me wonder if she just recognizes the name as maybe a name that's of an infamous character. Like if he said my name was Charles Manson or something like that. Or H.H. Holmes.
Right. Now that's a fair point. Again, there's a lot of winks and nods throughout the movie to things, I think, Mike. So that makes sense. Let's see. All right, so basically, the wraparound story, just to set it up, the whole movie, there's a guy that works at a mortuary. So he is basically the town funeral person. And he has a sign for a job or employment. He has an opportunity for people. So this young lady, about 20, 21, 22, comes in. Was curious about a coffin of a small child. And then she claims that she's actually there for the job. And so basically the interview really turns out to be four stories, three told by Montgomery Dark and one by the young lady named Sam. So I assume Samantha. And then there's a twist at the end related to these two characters. And that's pretty much it. The first three stories are kind of listed by or spoken by Montgomery and Sam as
morality tales.
That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you, Abe. And then the fourth is a little different because it could be partly
autobiographical.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Phantasmagorical.
Exactly.
Stop showing off, Eric.
Autobiographical. And whatnot. And then the wraparound takes place in the present and brings out what could be supernatural elements into the story, because the first three stories could just be tales that are told in the dark and not actual reality. And that's pretty much the setup. Yes, yes. So, all right, what do we want to talk about? I'm willing to start wherever anybody wants to speak, discuss what they want to bring up.
Well, one thing I like is that they focus it around the death of a child. That something absolutely horrible has happened to. And
I thought that was the end of your thought. I love that something horrible happened to a child.
Well, right. Well, that, like, for example, you know, so, and it's foreshadowing, but we don't realize that it is going to kind of pay off in the end. But given that the whole story is about life and death, I like the mention in the beginning. Said, the world isn't made up of atoms. It's made up of stories. You know, all of our stories have an end. And in this case, you know, he says something to that effect in delivering the eulogy or the sermon at the kid's funeral, is that he, it's not the length of the story. It's how you lived it. And of course, it doesn't really comfort anyone. We later find out we will find out how the child died.
Yeah.
But I just as a framing segment, I like that. And I did like the banter back and forth between the two of them. I like the fact that he's trying to scare her or impress her or something, move her with his stories. And she's just very nonchalant about the whole thing. And I kind of enjoyed that sort of banter back and forth between the two of them.
You know, one thing I liked about that wraparound thing, too, I really loved the concept of it's not just how they died, but why. And that kind of goes into the morality business, but it doesn't actually, because it's less about morality and more about these people's Achilles heel, their tragic faults, right? I mean, in the 1950s one, it's the girl is obviously a pickpocket, a thief. You know, and in the 1960s one, the kid is obviously kind of a suave user, although we do get his backstory as to why he became the person he became. In the third story, you have this tragedy, this guy who was just looking for his happily ever after, and it just turned to shit, and he's not a strong enough person to handle it, so he caves. And in the fourth one, you know, the girl is obviously like a psychopath or a sociopath. So I found it interesting that this really necessarily, these characters were not necessarily making choices to be bad. You know, it's kind of like Jessica Rabbit. I wasn't born bad. I was just drawn that way or whatever. I'm not bad. I was just drawn that way. And I thought that was really interesting that it played with that kind of idea as well. These four stories, it wasn't just that somebody was an asshole to be an asshole. There was a reason for it. And that's another reason that I appreciated the four tales in this, because it was like these characters, you almost felt empathy or sympathy for every single one of them. It wasn't that, you know, there was some, except for maybe the first one, I'd have to think about that, but yeah.
Let me ask you this, Chrissy. Oh. Speaking of that, what was your opinion of Montgomery Dark? Was he an evil villain or not? Because originally I thought he was going to be a bad guy, but then I was thinking maybe he was just, you know, the Grim Reaper type of bad guy where, you know, he just has to cast the judgment on individuals. But then at the end, I'm thinking maybe he was more to the dark side than I came to conclude prior.
I almost got the sense throughout this wraparound story that we don't know how he really became who he is, because he makes the girl into his successor. Right.
Yeah.
So it almost felt like it was a punishment for him to be there, and not necessarily that he got there by choice. That was sort of how I interpreted it. I may have missed some things, but I almost thought that his time was coming to an end. His period of torture or pain of being punished into doing this job and keeping this mortuary going was coming to an end, and he needed to find a successor. That's kind of how I read into this. If, I mean, maybe you guys read it totally differently, but that's what I got out of it. And so I felt sympathetic for him. And I think it was, too, he didn't seem to me to be truly evil through this. He seemed like a real person and not a caricature. Like there was another level underneath him that we just weren't really privy to seeing, but he was there. Now, then again, the actor, you know, it's a good actor. This guy's a good actor. So he might have just kind of built all of that into his performance for us to pick up on. Mm. But that was how I kind of felt
there,
about it.
There's also sort of like a very omnipotent kind of person, omnipotence to him. He kind of sees, and a way he, especially to the way he views life and death, which kind of clashes with how Sam, for different reasons than we might at first thought, view life and death and our decisions. Because he sees that life is actually, you know, there's fate. There's not much control over what happens. It's just how things go. Especially the kind of butts heads with Sam at one point for the third story, saying that the character in question, that tale, was fated to be stuck in that situation. That was his. Why should we question it? And so I guess in the way he views it, can be very, for some, narrow-minded and stuff like that. And there's even maybe some bit of very calculated in the way he draws Sam's in to her own fate. But, you know, even before that, we haven't got any sign that he was malicious or dangerous to anyone else.
Right. Well, he's a chronicler of stories. I don't get the sense that he's necessarily passing judgment necessarily. But he's relating the stories, he's relating the tales, and he's observing them. But what he is saying, and he does say to her, to Sam, is that, you know, we get the fates that we deserve. And certainly for three of the four stories, I guess you could argue that, at least for the main characters. You know, you could flip that around then and ask, what did the child do to deserve his fate? But I think that's more of a reflection on him. He mentions to her that he has a dark past. He's done some bad things, too. Which is what makes me wonder
if Chris is right that it's a punishment almost.
Right. That, and so we see how we see how his successor gets her job, which to me tells me it's probably how he got the job too. Right? That he came there and probably replaced somebody before him. And he too was there, lured there, and it was forced to serve for 100 years or whatever it was as penance for his sins. And then you see the relief he has at the end as he walks out of the mortuary and he's able to step past the threshold. And then he dies. Right. But he is free. He is liberated and he's happy to be free. And then sad that his freedom is very, very fleeting. And we, of course, don't know what happens to him after that. Did he pay off his penance and go to a great reward? Or does his true punishment now really begin? You know, or does he go to oblivion? We don't know what happens to him after that point. I guess all depending on your religious belief. Like, we never get a sense, does he ever atone for his crime, right? Did he ever repent what his crimes are? Because we don't know what his crimes are. But those are all, I think, interesting things to contemplate about the character. And you could read into it whatever you want based on the way he portrays him. But you do get this sort of, again, this sort of rich idea of he knows he's there because he did a bad thing. I don't know if he ever regretted the bad thing that he did. Or things that he did. And I'm not entirely sure. I mean, we see like he's, like Chrissy said, he's teasing the children. He's luring the children with their things, with the camera and their toys or whatever else he's confiscating. So there is a backstory to his character I think would be fascinating to find out, but I think it's one of those things that's better to leave to the imagination.
So are you trying to say, Mike, that he was a bad person to children?
Oh, I don't know if he was children. It'd be that he's stuck in that house. Grown-ass adults don't go running up to a spooky house. That's totally a kid thing to do. So they may be the only ones he gets to torture. I could see it go either way.
Gotcha. Yep. All right. I think going back to one of the points that Chrissy made, I think you're right, Chrissy, that the villains in the stories aren't necessarily real villains, especially in number two and number three. And in number one, a petty crook versus, I wouldn't call a terrible villain, though that is most certainly bad. And then obviously the fourth story is a different story because it's told from a different perspective by a different character. But the first three stories, I think you're probably right that the villains aren't really villains. They're just tough luck.
The thing is, they're humans with faults. It's really, they're not necessarily wonderful people. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that they're not. I'm just saying it's refreshing to see that they're not. Like, if you compare them with, like, say, if we look at Creepshow, right? And you look at, what's his name?
Mr. Pratt.
Like Ted Danson and what's his name in the seaweed one.
Something tied you over? Yeah.
Yes. Okay, Leslie, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting Nielsen. His last name. Leslie Nielsen. His character is just a fucking asshole. I mean, there's nothing going on there. It's just, here I am, I'm evil and jealous. These characters in this stories, they have a depth to them. It's not that they're, I'm not saying that they're not bad people. I'm just saying that I think they all got, there's a depth to them. They're not one-sided. They're the reasons that they are doing these bad things are sort of complicated. Like I said, I felt sympathy for all of them, except for the last one, the chick, because you could see easily that she was just, I don't know.
She was doing a public service.
Chrissy, would you say that the first three stories are like bizarro versions of biblical parables, maybe?
That's a really good question. I'd have to think about that. That would make sense.
Well, I mean, these are like fairy tales. They're cautionary tales, right? Don't be a thief. Don't be a douchebag.
Yep.
I don't even know what the cautionary tale would be for the third guy. Be prepared, when you get married, prepare for anything. There is not necessarily a life ever after, happily ever after coming for you. But the punishments in fairy tales are always way beyond the crime that the child or whatever in the fairy tale commits. You know, it's the horrific element, that it's not a tale of justice. It's a tale of the universe sort of bring all of its weight down to bear on you and disproportionate to the thing you do. I mean, if you think about which is going to the fourth tale, the classic horror trope of the slasher, killing the stoners and the virgins, not the virgins and the whores. Well, they may be stoners and whores. They don't deserve to have their heads crushed in Jason's hands, right? They don't deserve to have an arrow pushed through their throat. They're just assholes, or they're just misbehaving in some cases.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, is that like some of them, they're not even assholes, right? They're just doing some marriage before.
Some of them are just kids, they're just teens and stuff.
Yeah, well, like for example, the first Friday the 13th, a lot of those characters weren't even jerks, right? They just were, having sex and drinking a beer and singing songs around a campfire, and they would all get killed. They weren't even jerks, right? So, but then the slasher films change where it wasn't just sinners, but jerks as well.
But, right. Well, they also start recognizing. I don't think that was ever an intentional trope, but once they started to recognize it, they leaned into it more heavily.
Right.
So I think that's the case. And I think that's the case here, right? The characters are punished way beyond maybe what they deserve. The pickpocket deserves to be punished with a fine, you know, or community service, not to be consumed by Cthulhu, you know, or whatever that was.
Well, and yet so what was interesting about the pickpocket, though, is that if you looked at her outfit and her dress, it was very pretty and very pressed and everything, but it was also a little worn. It wasn't like brand new. It wasn't crisp. It wasn't exactly the fanciest thing a woman could wear. And so that, again, that tells me that goes back to this movie's economy. So that kind of told me, oh, I wonder why this woman's a pickpocket. Like, there must be some story behind this. Like, does she have no job skills? Does she, you know, did her husband leave her and she has no other way to make money? I mean, it just kind of put those things in my head. Too, or is she just, yeah. But I mean, but the fact that they make a point to show you when she's walking on the tiles that her shoes are kind of scuffed and not in great shape. So I was kind of like, I wonder if maybe there's a reason she's doing this. Like, maybe this is her survival, you know? And in that way, I felt kind of bad for her.
There was also something interesting in the way that the tentacles also felt like a very it's kind of like a representation of snatching, grabbing things to consume for yourself, you know?
Well, she does get consumed, that's for sure.
Well, yeah. I'm saying it's in terms of the sense, almost like slippery fingers and stuff like that. The way they grab things and clutch and stuff like that, because she's a pickpocket. She, you know, she quickly slips away, gets people's wallets, yeah, along and stuff like that. And
I wouldn't doubt she's more than a pickpocket too. She could be like a roller, you know, someone that like drugs people and then steals their money. Well, you know that, you know, because she seemed like she had what, four or five wallets, so or pretty close to that. And so,
but there's also interesting moment way before we discover what's behind the mirror is that she takes a nice long look of herself in the mirror at her own reflection, and it feels like it's like almost like the mirror, the opening of the mirror showing what's inside herself.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the biggest tropes in symbolic fiction is the reflection of oneself in the mirror can sometimes show the true self. Right?
So, you know, and this creature is like this insatiable, greedy creature, you know, always seemingly hungry entity. And I guess if we wanted to really talk about like sins and stuff like that, you can say either it's greed or gluttony in terms, because she has so many wallets and so much money she's just pulling out, but it's clear it's not enough for her.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And then she takes the items that aren't valuable, like the pictures and various other things, and just tosses it away like it's crapola. Other people's belongings mean nothing to her. All that matters is the items that have value.
Yeah, see, like Chrissy, you mentioned the sort of threadbare, the clothes maybe aren't as nice. To me, that evokes the guys, the con men from Huckleberry Finn, you know, who pose at being men of manners or men of royalty or men of breeding when they're just
or
hucksters.
Pinocchio.
Right. You know, they're just hucksters. And so they don't really belong in polite society, but they infiltrate it. She might have a more interesting backstory than that, but to me it's just she's just infiltrating the society to get at their goods, to take their things. That's the way I had read it. That's why I'd seen it, you know, and she certainly, I think, you talk about the universe coming down on somebody, sending a tentacle monster to consume somebody in the bathroom. That seems to be overkill. So I'm wondering how much, you know, whether she deserves, you know, if again, if his story, if the if Dark's story is, and is that these characters are getting what they deserve, or that they're getting their fates, maybe she, that is what she deserved.
Well, but then again, that door to that bathroom closet was locked. So it was her Achilles heel. It was, you know, she's a pickpocket. Ooh, here's a locked door. Let me see if I can get in it. I don't think that was necessarily there to punish her specifically. I think it was, again, it was her Achilles heel. And she was like, ooh, what's in here? And it just, it screwed her in the end. That was kind of what I got out of it. I don't know.
Oh, but the universe, I'm saying but the hand of fate, right? The universe putting her in that position.
Oh, that's true. Yep.
Yeah, that's true. She pays the ultimate price, but you're right, Mike. We don't know enough based off of what Montgomery Dock says, in the sense that maybe she did deserve it, or maybe it was overkill. We just don't know. We've seen this before in you know, Dante's Inferno, and whatnot, where a lot of folks are in the pits of hell, and some of the crimes that are listed didn't seem that big of a deal when I was reading some of that book, and yet they were appropriate for, I guess, Judeo-Christian what type of crime, what type of punishment. And I don't know, maybe this wasn't overkill.
And they didn't even know all the sins back then. I mean, back then, I don't even think they could have imagined that people could have, the concept of putting the toilet paper on the roll the wrong way, you know, things like that, that, you know, or talking in movie theaters, all that, they didn't have those sins back then. We'd need far more levels of hell now.
Yeah. And to get all trolls, those sinners in there. You know? Yeah, absolutely. The spammers. Can't spammer
the people who drive with the signal light on, all those people,
right?
We need levels for all those people.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else that we want to talk about on the first story?
No, short, sweet, it worked.
Yeah, that was pretty solid.
Yeah, it was really good. Good little story. All right, let's talk about the second story. We might as well just go in order. This one, set this one up. There's a college frat boy in the 1960s during the sexual liberation. He uses that to attract women to the frat parties that they have at his frat. Basically, he's going around passing out condoms, saying this gives you freedom and power because now you can force all your boyfriends or concubines to wear it, meaning you don't have to worry about pregnancy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then everything goes wrong because he's just doing that to get girls to come to the frat house. And then, of course, this turns into a morality tale of gender and whatnot. So
don't be a douchebag.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know. He is a douchebag is he a douchebag because he slept with 67 women, or is he a douchebag because he didn't use the condom when he said he was? I think it's that. I don't think he's a douchebag if he slept with 67 women, though.
Well, you know, this one was interesting because this kind of got into a little bit of social commentary. But again, we find out why this guy is so into sleeping with different women. And it's because he used to be heavy and he used to feel like kids would tease him and make fun of him. And he was really shit on. So this was his way of sort of reinventing, like, hey, I'm not the fat kid I used to be. Now look at me now. Like, and so it almost made you feel bad, but this story, I think, is like a social commentary because it puts the guy in the woman's shoes. You know,
it reverses it. Yeah.
It really does. That whole horror of oh my God, I slept with a guy, I might be pregnant. Mm-hmm. Like, that is really scary for a young woman who is not anticipating a pregnancy. And so I think they keyed very well into that sense of horror of that moment, you know, for the guy to go through it. I thought that was really interesting.
And the way that the two characters, the woman and the frat boy, play off each other is a reversal of how one, you know, this kind of situation happens. You know, the woman gets pregnant and she's frightened and she's, you know, now in a situation that she's desperate to get out of. And some guys are just completely indifferent to their responsibility, you know, because we find out later that this is not the first time this has happened.
Which cracked me up, by the way. Yeah. Lovely.
I mean,
she's like, her mother's like, get down here. I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Like, I mean, just like,
it's literally a reversal of the situation if the girl was, you know, if the judges were flipped.
Right. The difference here is that for a woman, she doesn't do it to herself. A woman engaging in this, first of all, she knows what the risks are necessarily. But which is a little different because he didn't know this was a possibility, but he lies to her, right?
Yeah,
it's hard. A woman doesn't lie to the guy and tell him she put a condom on him when she didn't. You know, it's a guy's going to notice that.
Well, the pill. They could say, yeah.
But the woman's not going to do that if she doesn't want to get pregnant.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
She's not going to be indifferent to it the way he was.
Right. That's what I think was the problem with this short here, was because it was originally about him having unprotected, basically being a liar. But then it switches to the quote-unquote unfairness of one sex having to carry, you know, for 9 months. And so I don't know. I felt what it was trying to say just didn't work, because it started out one way and then ended a different way. And it was like, it just didn't make sense.
Well, I think the guy's insidious in that he's using Karl Marx and feminist theory and trying to use bullshit philosophy to basically get in women's pants.
Yep.
Right. And he admits that's what he's doing. He doesn't believe a single word he is saying. He has no intention of forming any kind of relationship with any of these women, of being he's being disingenuous with them from the get-go, which to me is the thing that makes him a douchebag. He may have been heavy. And by the way, I found that a little forced, because, yes, we find out this reveal at the end, but we don't get any really a much of a sign of that until he basically blurts it out, and it feels a little bit forced in. But he chose to reinvent himself as a douchebag. And that's his fault. You know, whether you can understand it or not is one thing, but he made that decision. You know, that he was just, oh, well, now I've lost weight. Now I'm a good looking guy and I'm a charming guy. And by the way, the actor, I think, is fantastic in the role. Right, because I think he's very charismatic in that part.
Right. He's basically the male version of a overweight woman who loses a lot of weight, and then everybody finds out that she's actually
gorgeous. Well, that's
what
they're trying to do here. It's like, literally just a role reversal. And the way, especially the way how indifferent she reacts, she actually starts talking to another date as he's writhing in front of her parents.
So I think that this whole story then is, because you're right, she's talking to another date, is how women feel when they are taken advantage of by a lying guy, basically. Because it's doing many things. It's talking about lying about protection, lying being forced to have an unwanted pregnancy, about showing indifference to someone because you see someone else that's better, So I guess that's what it's trying to say then, I guess. But
right, and he's not interested in them as people. He's interested in them for their bodies. He's not interested in getting them pregnant. He just doesn't want to wear a condom. It's right. That indifference and that callous indifference
right.
That I think is what's most objectionable there.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. Either way, I couldn't stand this story. It was too comical. And then, you know, when the water breaking with all his buddies there, and in other words, it wasn't realistic at all. And when I say obviously it's not going to be realistic because there's a man that's pregnant, but what I mean is even the other characters weren't confused with what was going on. So it was, this one was truly more,
well, I mean,
terrible rather.
Yeah,
than,
yeah, this was as I said earlier, this is, you know, this story and others take major logic leaps. I mean, yeah, the very first clue should have been his buddy who's so dumb. I could
Oh my god.
Like he's so stupid. There's no way he could have gone to Yale.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and none of those guys would have been.
It wasn't
frat
Yale.
House. They wouldn't be in a frat.
Well,
house.
You know what I'm saying. It was a very, you know, high class college.
It was Ravens and.
Well, that's kind of fun. That was when I was saying they were having some very interesting things in this movie with, you know, doing little nods to Lovecraft, which is a whole. I mean, the fact that there was a university in this town to me was
Chrissy.
Like miskatonic. Yes.
Chrissy, what's the name of that college in Connecticut that's small but, well, very, very high regard? Is it Middlebury? Or something like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I think it's Middle. No, isn't that Vermont? Middlebury? I don't know.
Yeah.
Wesleyan? I don't know. Wesleyan.
No. It begins with M. It's Middle something. But I think that's what Abe is trying to say, Mike, is that this wasn't just your local community college or state college. This was a high end, smaller college, like Middlebury or whatever it's called that I'm thinking of in Connecticut.
I mean, this because his buddy is so dumb. He's like, how the fuck does he function? Like, he is. It's like, I know you, sometimes you have.
You've never heard of Legacy Admissions?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Middlebury College. That's what it's called.
Yeah, Middlebury.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I honestly never have.
Yeah, basically that means Abe is if. You obviously haven't seen Animal House, but basically what it is if your family...
Oh, I have seen Animal House.
Okay, then you just forgot. Basically, if your family was graduates from the university, you have, you're called a legacy, and you're more apt to get in because...
Bill, let's be a little more specific. If your parents graduated from a university and give money to the university...
Yeah. That's fair. Right. Pretty exactly. Much. So you can be a stupid dumbass as we've seen in a lot of these wealthy political families that their kids go to these colleges just because of their name and who has donated money from their family.
Ah, I see. So it's and, just through influence and shit.
Yeah, exactly. Nepotism, cronyism, influence, all that good stuff, yeah.
Right, because the question is, how does a kid like that even get into that particular frat? And
right.
Probably because of legacy, because dad was probably a frat bro, too.
Yeah, exactly, that's a good point, yeah. Because there's, I'm looking at these guys, I go, these guys would not be in this frat. But you're absolutely right, if they're legacies, they would have to be taken in. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And, especially back then. When college was not, you know, quite as egalitarian as it is now, you know, where it was pretty much reserved for the special people.
Right, right. Anything else on this story, or do you want to go on to the next one?
I mean, it's just, you know, there's not much to really say except... if you wanted to see a dick explode, well,
yes, and that certainly is something to mention at the end of the year. I think in the year in review, look, this is the dark comedy episode.
Yeah,
you know, of the four segments, this is the and I enjoy that. I enjoyed this splat stick, the gross out humor.
It was the ball buster.
Yeah.
It's kind of,
it is
it's
also just for the Jordy Verrill episode.
What's Jordy? Oh yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, this one, this story kinda was not good in my opinion. But it appears other folks may have liked it. But yeah, you're right, Jordy. That's a good example from Creepshow. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up on this story? Should we move to the next one? All right, let's move to the next one. So the next one, this is one that Chrissy said she liked the best. This is based, and I actually enjoyed it. I just felt it lasted too long, and the payoff really didn't work. But it's basically a guy is married to a woman. And it looks like he's going to be happily ever after, but she becomes ill and he becomes her caretaker. And he has a neighbor that is clueless, who keeps on saying all these things like, too bad that you're not single, because then you could, you know, but this and that. And you know, so he kind of, and it's an older woman that's too, it's not like another.
Well, guy. it's an old widow.
Yeah, exactly. And she's saying how her life is wonderful because she doesn't have any responsibilities and you can go party, go on cruises and whatever. And he's stuck at home taking care of, in a sense, a woman, a person that can't speak, you know, is basically comatose. And he's always depressed and whatnot. And then his doctor kind of tries to give him an out, and then everything goes bad and whatnot. So that's pretty much how the story goes. So what do we want to talk about on this one? Anyone?
Well, first of all, just a reminder that this is the doctor that also declared Jake pregnant in the previous episode.
Yes.
So there's that. Just well, that little bit of a connection.
That's the
tissue.
One thing that's weird about all these tales is that the last story is probably quote unquote true, but the other three were told through a parable by the Montgomery Dark. So all I can think of is how could the doctor be in the other stories if he's, you know, because he's quote unquote real in the third and the fourth story. All I can think of is that when he's telling the story, Montgomery Dark is telling the story, Sam is imagining these stories in her head, and she just places that doctor as the doctor in these stories. But you know, maybe I'm overthinking stuff, but anyway, continue, Mike.
Yeah, I think you might be overthinking it a little bit much. Again, these are stories, and you know, who knows how old it is. The doctor mentions, you know, with the Jake story that he's not allowed to cut anybody anymore, not allowed to do surgery.
He has not allowed a knife, yeah.
So there's a story for him somewhere as well, that's out there. So the story is, basically he tries to kill his wife. Sadly, reluctantly, the doctor gives him this medication that will in theory give, an undetectable homicide or euthanasia. Right. So we'll be able to get away with murdering his wife, and then he can go on and live his life. And we're given a little bit of a taste of what his existence is and how, you know, kind of sad it is.
Go ahead.
Right. And so here's the guy, I think that he's the one that is, I think, the most sympathetic. Mm-hmm. He does decide to do a thing. He doesn't want to do the thing. He doesn't know if he should do the thing. But you can understand why he's kind of in agony. He's in agony, one, because his life sucks. He's also watching this woman that he loved, and we see the flashbacks to when they met and all this, and when they got married. You know, who's this, you know, beautiful young woman who is now nothing, right? She's just sitting in a chair as a vegetable, and being spoon-fed by her husband. You know, at her young, even at a fairly young age, she's growing bed sores from this, and he doesn't really know what to do. And the doctor comes along and offers him a way out, and you can understand the weakness of that temptation. You know, doesn't necessarily make it right, but you can certainly understand why he would do that.
Well, and it's even a little bit worse than that, in that you know, you can see that he is a good guy. Like, he doesn't lose patience with his wife when he's feeding her and when he's caring for her. This is actually really kind of a romantic tragedy. And that's why I kind of said it's also the most Poe-esque tale of the three. He's a man who's been pushed over the edge, into madness out of oppression. That's one of Poe's four big triggers. He literally can't take it anymore. And his tipping point is when the doctor says to him, well, she's doing okay. And he says, well, does that mean, do you mean she's improving? And the doctor says, no, she's fine. Like, her vitals are good. She's fine. But of course, this woman is just, like you said, a vegetable. She can't even open her mouth to really be fed. Half the food that he makes for her, which he throws all these elaborate meals and makes them beautifully, plates them beautifully, and then dumps them into a blender. It's really sad. I mean, and that in itself is like a metaphor for, here's this beautiful life I thought I was going to have, and look how it got all fucked up and
literally shredded. Well, literally shredded.
Yeah.
Well,
And the thing is, when the doctor – so – but when the doctor's telling him this, this guy is trying to figure out their finances, and that's his breaking point where he's literally like, so how long are we talking? It's not like Mike said. It's not like he wants his wife to die. He almost gets to a point where he's like, Jesus, she just needs to die so that this hell can end, because we see that he loves her. It's not like he doesn't. You know, right. if he were a bastard, he just would have killed her some other way.
Well,
like,
this is the thing is you could argue that her passing would be his deliverance, but you could even argue that it could be her deliverance too, right? Because no one, I mean, it's not like she just or any disability. She's basically almost brain dead in a sense. Right.
Right.
I mean, so she has no true existence. She can't really do anything. And so and to be honest, assuming it's only if he had finances or if it is finance related, you would think someone would have her at in a assisted living home or something rather than having her at home being taken care of. Of as you mentioned, Chrissy, where you know he's using the blender, he can't work to even support himself because he has
right.
to there has to be someone there at all times for her. So it is completely tragic because not only his life is horrible and he's making decisions that he doesn't want to make, but her life is horrible too because some debilitating disease or something or injury has made her non-functioning completely.
Well, and there's a really interesting thing going on in here too with the hares. You know, she has all these statues of these hares, these mm-hmm. rabbits all over the apartment. At the opening of the story, we see them with her and they're watching her, but then they sort of shift and it's almost like they're watching him. Until he decides he's going to kill her, and he does that first act of poisoning her. But what's super interesting about this is that here's it's specifically he mentions the Arctic hare. This is an animal that is really important to the Inuit, and there's a folk story that they tell that they've passed down for generations that actually has an interesting subtextual connection to this particular segment. In the winter, hares have to eat lichens. The Arctic hares have to eat these lichens that cover the rocks because food is really scarce. So starvation during the wintertime is a huge issue for these animals. It's really a struggle for them to feed themselves. The Inuit legend is called the fox and the hare. And in the legend, the hare tries to continue the hunt in the bleak of winter because he has married a female fox and he has promised to provide all of the prey for her that she can eat. However, he fails in that promise. And in his shame, he tells her that he must, they have to separate. They can no longer be together because he is unable to take care of her. So essentially, that's what this story is. It's like a retelling of the Fox and the Hare, right? He's literally kind of saying, I have to let you go because I can't take care of you.
Chrissy, let me ask you this. When he did begin to poison her and she started choking, he actually tries to save her, right? So I don't even know if he really wanted to let her go, which is kind of interesting.
Well, he begs her to give him a sign, give him some hope that
he was
still
at a breaking
there.
Point. Yeah, he didn't want to. It just, he felt completely defeated at that point.
Well, and there's another interesting thing in this, because there's this moment, and I may be crazy here, but I think I have enough to maybe back up my theory. He finds their wedding album, and that moment was actually very touching. But there were all of these herbs in between the pictures and stuff. And then there's that, you know, and then there was the moment where the doctor says, oh, her vitals are really strong. She could go on living like this for a long time. And then there's a moment where he's in the elevator and he sees the beautiful flashbacks and he's smiling at them. And that's where I think he really crosses over into madness, which, by the way, that whole elevator sequence was beautiful. Just the imagery in that was gorgeous. But he's looking at her and we see, you know, him asking her to marry her. And she's like all excited and says yes. And then like she gives him this like dark look, and I honestly wasn't sure if it was like out of his guilt that he was imagining that dark guilt, but for 1 second I put that shit together in my head and I went, oh, I wonder if maybe she's supernatural, maybe she's slightly supernatural, like maybe she's actually preying on him. I don't know. I think I have enough to back it up. I think there might, I'd have to watch it again.
But is she preying on him because she's evil, like demonic, or preying on him just because?
No, I just wondered if maybe she was a witch or something. Like,
okay,
you know.
And she wasn't a bad guy. She wasn't there trying to.
She's a witch!
Burn her! Burn her!
That's just an entity, evil entity that.
That she's not an evil entity, that she's an actual witch.
Well, that's
like she made him fall in love with her because she wanted someone to take care of her. So she manipulated him into taking care of her and falling in love. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Right. When I said entity, I meant that semantically, not as in like a spiritual being or something. But yeah, fair enough. Yeah, so okay, all right. So he's just a victim. He's not being punished.
Well, that's one way to look at it.
It's a possibility. I mean, the text is that he's being punished for trying to murder his wife, right? If you go literally by what's there. And the punishment is he's punishing himself, right? He breaks over the guilt.
Right. I think he was gone. Even if he didn't attempt to kill her, he was going insane anyway. And I think he was doomed no matter what.
He probably was already mentally threadbare to begin with.
Yeah. If she just passed away naturally, then I think his sanity would have came back. But as long as she was there or him trying to kill her, I think his sanity was gone.
Well, and you could see how happy they were. Like, there is that,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
We do see the wedding. I mean, they were both really happy. And so that's why I think this is more just a romantic tragedy. And also, it's Poe-esque, everybody drink, because it also parallels Poe's own life. You know, he lost his beloved wife to a very devastating illness. He watched her die. So there's parallels with that, too, you know.
Right, right.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, you know, he tried. If he poisoned his wife, she dies. There's no trace of what happened, hypothetically, right, according to what the doctor said. But that's not what happened. The wife falls down and pales her head onto a steel arctic hare after he tries to save her, right? Because she reaches out, she grabs him, and he gets her to vomit up the pills. And they sit her back down in the chair, and she falls over headfirst onto the I think it's a pewter rabbit sculpture, and kills herself that way. Now, who's going to believe that story, right?
Right.
Now it's almost certainly going to be looked at as murder. Now he's really fucked. So he tried to do the right thing, but he's still punished. His wife still dies, and now he's going to get blamed for killing his wife even though he didn't do it. And I think that may be the thing that finally pushes him over the edge.
Right, right. Yeah. But you know what? He was somewhat, even though he didn't kill her, he didn't call the medical people either to try to help, because he decided to take the, well, actually, yeah, because, oh, that's right, he already thought she was dead, because right, when he put her in the tub, we find out that she actually wasn't. But either way, he was going to try to dispose of, not give her a proper burial, put it that way, which itself is a crime because of a crime against a corpse or something. There's some sort of crime that I forget what it's called, but you have to, you can't treat a corpse with except with dignity.
Well, I mean, for what he does to that body, it's much cleaner than it should have been. Because he takes a fucking electric knife and takes away some of her limbs, and he only gets a slight bit of spray paint for that.
Right. Well, and when she was not dead, and we find out she's alive, and again, we're not seeing her perspective necessarily, except that she freaks out, you would think that her horror of seeing her own spouse, or the one she loves, trying to cut her while she's still alive, even though he didn't know it, must have been a horrifying thing to know that you're being killed by the person that you love and is supposed to love you.
The makeup on the head wound was really well done.
Yeah, oh yeah, there's no doubt that the effects in this film were fairly good. Even the CGI was not too bad. Anything else on this story? Anything else?
I did like when he's going through the whole thing on the elevator and he's hallucinating. I really liked the design of the mummified bride.
Yes. That was cool. Yeah.
Really beautiful. Yeah.
Did he really hurt that guy's arm?
Oh, the guy hurt it by sticking it into a closing door.
Right. Yeah, and this is an old-fashioned elevator. It's not one of the modern ones that would, in theory, just reopen up. We had, unfortunately, one of the incident where a woman died in Boston just a couple of months ago because of one of those old elevators that malfunctioned. One of those elevators that code doesn't matter anymore because it's grandfathered in, and that was a mistake. All right, so anything else anybody wanted to talk about on this episode? I mean, or I should say this story. All right, I guess we can move on to the babysitter story. Yeah, so this is the one that, as Mike mentioned, 2016 was the film that got this guy noticed, and he decided to make an entire motion picture, full-length motion picture, around the babysitter story. And the only way to do that without extending the babysitter story was to make an anthology, and so he did that. Yeah, so this is the story that I like the most. I at first was worried because I thought they were making the final girl a superhero again, which is the new hip thing in horror films. But in actuality, what it was is she was the mass murderer. And I kind of got that pretty early. I actually didn't think that the guy that she was trying to kill was the babysitter, but I did think the guy that she was trying to kill was either a mental patient that was harmless or a person that was not a bad person. And then I kind of guessed at halfway point that maybe she was the murderer and the intruder. And sure enough, I was right. So I'm doing pretty good, Dale. I'm predicting stuff. I'm proud of myself.
Well, I mean, part of it is, if you know these stories, they all have to end, I don't want to say with a twist, but they can't just take a straight line. So something has to happen in it that is
different than the standard.
Right. Very clear from the way the guy is behaving that he isn't, he's not a murderer. So something's going on here. And so I was expecting it to be that she completely misunderstood who this person was. You know, maybe she let the story of the escaped lunatic get into her head and she's attacking a perfectly innocent person. Or maybe he's not the violent psychopath that he's portrayed as. I wasn't expecting to go where they go. And I really did love where they ended up going with this. Which is killing and eating small children. Yes.
His fetish.
Yes. So, yeah. So, like, you know, because you see her early on, you know, they have the Phil moment of somebody preparing their dinner. You know, Phil loves those moments and things. and then you find out later that she's grinding up the boy. You know, and little things like, you know, again, work plays differently when you think back on it. Where was the kid? And you think he's in the hiding in his little hideout. No, he's not in the bed, not because he's on the hideout, but because he's in the oven.
Right. Yeah. One thing that made me catch on probably quick was when basically to set up the story, Sam tells a story about how she was a babysitter or what appears to be a babysitter. And then there's a story on the news that a sanitarium had some sort of accident, fire or something, and all the patients escaped. And a number of them are mass murderers that are very dangerous. And then there's a scene where she's outside throwing out the garbage and it's raining, and then when she walks back in, suddenly a guy pops up with a bloody head, and her expression wasn't panic or fright. It was more, and it wasn't even concerned. It was more like, I don't know. There was just something odd about it. And
I've
so,
seen this movie.
Yeah. So that was when I was thinking that, all right, so maybe there's something weird about her too. And then eventually it occurred to me that she was actually the mental patient and she had knocked the guy in the head earlier. And that's what her expression was like, damn, he's not dead, or damn, he's still he's come to or something.
But one of the things I liked about this is that this is very much an homage to the slasher genre, but specifically to Halloween. You know, Halloween was originally called the Babysitter Murders. Throughout Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis she's babysitting the kids because it's Halloween night. Duh, they've got scary movies on the TV in the background.
Yeah, The Thing from Another World, such.
Right, and so you get this because the same thing's going on here. It's the babysitter. It's not Halloween, I don't think. I don't think they specified a time. But she's got a horror movie. She's got a slasher movie going on in the background, and they're using the slasher movie to juxtapose the action going on screen, and that's simply further misdirection to try to get you to think he's a killer, she's the
final girl.
Right. So when you find out it's not, and it turns out that she's a cannibal killer, and then the horror of the parents coming home and opening the oven.
I will say, Mike, I'm with you on this. Even though this was my least favorite, boy, did I love – I did not see any of that coming either. So I know Phil did, but, like, when they did that, when that happened, I was like, oh, wow, damn, they pulled it over on me.
You know? I was
It was fun. Yeah, that one was
I guess you could say that the twist was well done.
But yeah, I was when they lift the TV off the guy's head, the parents, and they say, "Oh my God, it's the babysitter. He's dead." I was like, "No way, I'm right." And then I go, "Oh my God, the kid is dead." And sure enough, they went there, and I was like, "This was fantastic because it didn't pull punches, and it also didn't follow the regular script of right. these type of films." And so I felt it was phenomenal because of that. So
and it was of the three stories, I think the best twist. If you're going to have it, it's the one that was right, because that's the thing, right? The story starts out with the woman in the getting attacked by the tentacles, and Sam says, "Oh, well, that's not, you know, that's kind of predictable, don't you think?" Right? She's completely not impressed by his story because it's very obvious and straightforward. Petty criminal punished through cosmic justice, you know. And so here you finally get that story that has the twist. She gives him the story with the twist, and so I liked that.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. I also liked how they did the gender role change, where the babysitter is a male and the mass murderer, psychopath, cannibal is the female. And I thought that was good too, because that kind of changed it up. And to be honest, you know, Sam is the villain of the entire movie when you really think yes. about it. And I thought that was a cool twist too, because you usually don't see that. And the way she was a villain is different than the standard way they would make a woman as a villain too. So I felt that was a twist too. So it was pretty solid. I liked that 22 minutes of the babysitter murders a lot. And I know it doesn't have anything to say culturally or whatever, like the other stories, or specifically story 2 and 3, I felt it was the most fun and the main reason why I would want to watch a horror film. And so that I think the
commentary is very clear, which is that you don't want to leave your children in the oven too long.
Yes, that was a good meal. That was a good meal ruined, right? I mean, it burnt because she had to bail. She couldn't finish. Yeah, that's a good point, Mike. Good point.
This is for my dinner.
Now, Phil, this is what I have to know, though. When you're preparing your child, do you chop them or snap them?
I don't know. I don't think I would prepare a child, so I just don't know.
Just eat it raw out of the box?
Yeah, I guess so, Mike. I don't know. I'm not a cannibal, so I can't really speak.
So you say...
Well, you know what? If you want to speak of a raw meat, the third story, there was one scene where the guy was eating sushi. That's raw. I guess that wasn't funny, but it was true. He was eating sushi one scene.
Go to your room.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Phil. I don't. That might have been funny. It might not have been. You broke up. I completely missed it. Other than.
Oh, you'd be glad, Mike. It wasn't funny.
Yeah, it wasn't that.
I'm trying to make him feel good. Why? Just because. So
it's the holiday season, Eric. Please, please. No,
but
reason.
You still deserve to be punished for that because you're naughty.
Punish, naughty. If you see Santa, you better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Nice.
Awesome. All right. Anything else about the babysitter? Or let me rephrase, babysitter. Anything else?
Oh my God, Phil just pronounced an R
at the end of a word.
Shit.
I did that intentionally.
He can pronounce them at the beginning of words. That's why they don't root for the Ed Sox.
Such a good
boy. That's true.
So,
I guess we get to the wraparound, or was it something?
Yeah, like, and this finishes off the wraparound segment, and I think, you know, this is part of why I liked it so much, is that you really get a good climax here. Right? So now that she's revealed as a sinner, you know, and she's not really there for the job opening, that she's there to take a trophy from, you know, a trophy tooth from the kid's mouth before they put him in the incinerator.
Right, right. So that is Lucas, I think the boy's name was. I forget, but
Logan.
Yeah, Logan, that's it. Yeah, so she is there to get, the only true reason she's there is she just wanted to get a tooth from Logan's corpse because she's known as the Tooth Fairy Cannibal Killer, and her trophy is taking one tooth from every child that she kills and eats. And she never was able to get Logan's because she had to flee the house because the parents came home.
That was so inconsiderate.
I know. She probably should have just killed the parents too and then finished her meal. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's not her MO.
No, you're right. You're right. It's not the MO.
That is not the way.
So this film has a couple of endings based off of that, because they could have ended it where she, meaning Sam, announces who she is to Montgomery Dock, and then Montgomery Dock brings the punishment upon another sinner, and they could have just ended it there. But then they make it where he becomes free and she replaces him after she is killed and resurrected. And that was still good too, but I think it would have been better had she been just killed off as a punished person and they ended it there. I think I would have liked it better there.
Well, here's the thing. I flipped on this because I did very much like Clancy Brown as Montgomery Dark. And I told you, like, I already had visions in my head of this becoming like a series and him being your crypt keeper. And I kind of dug that idea of having him come in, because I did enjoy the character and having, you know, these two actors together for future installments, I would have enjoyed. And so when they killed her off, I was like, oh, and I see him bringing her back. And I was like, okay, you know, he's putting her back together. I was like, okay, maybe she's still going to be a thing. But then he leaves and he dies. I'm like, oh, they're going to make her? You know, like, if there's a sequel, if she's going to be the mortuary right. keeper? It's like, that's just disappointing. And then you get the final shot of her. And I loved the look they came up with for her.
Right.
And so I did, too. That was cool.
Also, she's not a punisher like him either. She's just evil because she's going to kill the paperboy and eat him.
Right. Well, we don't know what how he started out. He's apparently had this job for a long time. We don't know how many of those toys were taken from dead kids.
Right. That's true. That's true. Yeah. But she, as the new mortician, at least in this point, is very different than him, right? I mean,
yeah, clearly.
As Abe, you said earlier, Montgomery Dark, to those who aren't sinners, he's, you know, because he had the eulogy and he's really trying hard to make them feel good, even if he screws up. And he's only punishing people that you could argue are sinners.
He's also, in a way, of doing what was they started to do, giving her a job. I mean, she signed her name and everything.
Right, but the difference I'm saying is that, and Mike had a good point too, which is, well, she's just beginning. Maybe Montgomery Doc was like her when he first began too, but she's still the psychopath, tooth fairy, cannibal murderer when she takes over the job, right? She's not just the Grim Reaper judgment person that Montgomery...
Well, maybe he was too. We don't know.
That's what I'm saying. Mike mentioned that. He said that maybe Montgomery was too prior to you know, many years doing this. But I don't know, Mike. I don't think they can bring him back if they do a sequel.
Well, they could. If they wanted to, they could tell us his story, just as they told us hers. You know, she could tell his story to whoever she's going to be telling stories to in the next thing. But yeah, probably not. I'm curious how much he cost to get for this film, or like, is he friends with the filmmaker?
Well, it's a great role for someone that wants to get noticed. So I could see him taking it, not on the high end, just to get a starring role in a sense, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know how much he's worth. Because, I mean, he's a character actor. He's been around for a while. At the same time, he does have all that Mr. Krabs money because he voices Mr. Krabs on SpongeBob SquarePants.
That is true, he does. Yeah.
And I do not know how much that pays to voice a character on, like, the most popular kids' TV show for the last 25 years.
Right. That's a good point, yeah. Yeah, that show is pretty old when you think about it. That popular.
I mean, I don't think he's getting Simpsons money.
Right, but he's getting Luke Hamill money, probably.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So he should be doing pretty well. But, you know, again, he just may have done it for fun.
More than Luke Hamill, because SpongeBob is, yeah, that's a huge show. And it's been on for years, like you said, so his salary probably just
Phil, going up. Yep. Just before the Star Wars nerds attack you, the actor's name is Mark Hamill, and the character's name is Luke Skywalker.
You're right. Luke Hamill is awesome.
Well, I don't even know how much, like, Mark Hamill got as a voice actor, because he started as a voice actor.
Sure.
I don't know, like, how much he got for doing the voice of the Joker, right, in the Batman series, because he wasn't doing anything. I mean, he was starring in very low-budget films, you know, at that point. And the Batman series didn't necessarily go 25 years.
Right. That's a fair point, yeah. All right. Anything else anybody want to bring up about the film that we have?
$3 million. He's only worth $3 million. Yeah, so he's going to be cheap to get.
Who this the guy that played
Clancy Brown?
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah. All right. So, anything else anybody want to bring up about any of the stories or the wraparound?
They were phantasmagorical.
Yeah, I think I'm about done. I don't really have anything.
Eric is going to hug himself to sleep tonight, just repeating phantasmagorical, phantasmagorical, phantasmagorical.
When he wakes up,
and he deserves it too.
When he wakes up the next day, he's not going to be able to say anything else but that word.
All right, sounds good. So we're already almost an hour and 55 minutes recording, so I guess we can just give our final thoughts on this film. But before we do, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan, and I think you said you're about to start another weekly podcast, or is that just a temporary thing?
That's a vicious rumor. No, I think I am. I don't know how it happened. The General Interest podcast I do with my friend Dan is called the Askancy podcast. That's spelled Askancity. The other podcast it's not even out yet, so I don't even know
if you
I want to talk about it. Because,
yeah, if you want to give details later.
I mean, all I know so far is that we recorded a thing, and it might be released as a podcast, and if it is, it will be called The Basement Movie Cast.
And what was the thing that you recorded?
We basically did, myself and two other people did a kind of commentary track for Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But Eric, the most important thing we need to know. Will there be pants?
Well, I mean, it's an audio podcast, so use your imagination.
Now, Eric, who's the third co-host? Because you said Scott Smith, right?
Yes, and the other gentleman is named Brian.
Is he new to podcasting, or do you
I believe so. Yeah, I think this is his first go at it.
And is he a Canadian, too?
Scott's not a Canadian,
I thought Scott was Canadian.
You're thinking of Doug.
Doug, okay. So Doug's the only one that was Canadian out of the bunch of them.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. For some reason, I thought they were all Canadians. Okay.
Nope.
Okay, so that's good. And also mention to those guys, if they want to have it as part of the Dark Discussions network, just let me know and we'll get them on board. But if not, that's cool too.
Yep.
All right, sounds good. And let's see, Mike, me, you, and Eric sometimes do a podcast. Technically, it's supposed to be once a month, but you've had it on hiatus because of your business.
Work in Lovecraft Country. I've been wanting to talk to you about when we want to do the next episode of that anyway. So, yes, it is a cinema à la carte, a refined look at distinguished foreign films. In the oeuvre of whatever the fuck we feel like watching. The phantasmagorical French language film noir, cinema vérité, in other words, that I just learned in one film class. Anyway, so it's basically Eric and Phil and I talking about whatever movie one of us selected to watch that month or ish. And it was basically meant as a fill-in podcast for when we are not doing another spin-off podcast of Dark Discussions, because we also have, do the Beyond Westworld, and we had done Game of Thrones, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow.
And we're never doing any more.
And it was to do something else to fill that in. And then Phil and I, along with Kevin Letts and Barrett, what's his name?
Eisner did
Lovecraft Country. So basically, when those things are not going, once a month we would be doing this, and we take turns doing an episode. And so, for instance, Eric chose Inside Out, and Phil had chosen The Little Dog Movie, and I had chosen Forbidden Planet. And Stalin, that was it. Stalin, I'm almost remembering it a year later. I'm almost remembering the name of the damn movie.
Best film ever.
But stuff that would not normally fit under the traditional Dark Discussions umbrella. So that way, when things come out, like, I don't know, Wonder Woman 84, Phil, we can put it under there and watch it there, as opposed to trying to find a way to justify putting it into Dark Discussions.
Indeed.
Well, Dark Discussions is similar to Now, Chrissy, you do some things.
I do. I write a lot of short fiction. You can check me out at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. I also have a literary magazine, and I have my fingers in a lot of pies, and right now I'm just trying to update my really outdated website. So go visit it.
All right, very good. And if you ever want to do any articles for Doc Discussions Network, just let me know, and we'll get them up. It's all good.
Fingers, thanks. Eyes.
I knew.
You got exactly my vibe there, Eric.
All right, so let's start with you, Abe. Final thoughts on the Mortuary Collection.
Well, it might not be a knockout film, especially in the subgenre of anthology films. I thought it was well made. I thought Clancy Brown was really strong in his performance, and while it's a shame his character has kind of made an exit if they ever plan to do sequels down the road, if that's even going to be a thing, I still thought he was really fun to watch. The stories are going to, I think, for as you can see, as you heard tonight, how everyone's going to enjoy them or view them, in terms of context and stuff like that, is going to vary from one person to the other. You might like some stories, you might like all of them, you might not like any of them. Some might be stronger than others for you. Even though I did overall enjoy the film, I did find some stories to be mixed bags in certain points. But I couldn't deny that there was a lot of strong stuff in here too. Still, if you want to check out maybe a little stronger films in that subgenre like Trick or Treat, Creepshow,
VHS,
yes, thank you, or others like that.
Patient 7.
Southbound.
As you can see, there's still bigger choices, a lot more prominent choices that you go to. But this film is not going anywhere. So if you want to just check those out before going to this one. And it'll still be here waiting on Shudder.
All right, very good. Chrissy.
Hi. I liked this movie. I think if you enjoy these anthology types of films, then this is one to put on your list. It's not, I mean, honestly, I may forget it that I ever saw it like 2 years from now. It's not very memorable, I don't think, but it's fun and it's kind of light for the most part. And like I said, if you enjoy this type of thing, definitely put this one on your list.
All right. Very good. Mike.
Yeah, I think this was a for me a right film at the right time. It kind of hit the spot. It is not, you know, reinvention of the genre. It is not going to be the top of my list the way something like, say, 1BR might be. But I just enjoyed it. I had fun with it. And that's all I think it was intended to be. It's not a deep film by any means. It is an anthology film that has all the strengths and all the weaknesses of most anthology films. But what it does do, it flips the script, and that possibly, based on the opinion of five randomly selected people from the northeastern United States, be the first time in cinema history where the wraparound segment was the strongest story out of the five stories presented. But otherwise, I enjoyed all the stories to one degree or another. I had fun with it. I really liked that. And that's what's going to stick with me, by the way. Chrissy is going to be Clancy Brown's Montgomery Dark, and the final image of Sam as the new mortician. I think that's probably what'll stick with me over the exploding penis, of course. I do want to say, you know, I did. I don't know. I made a prediction at the beginning of the podcast, and I don't know if it came true. I'm kind of confused. Eric, what was the prediction?
The prediction was that Phil was going to protect the frat boy.
Was defend the douchebag, I think is what
yeah.
I said.
Yeah. And he started to, but then he kind of listened to reason, which is, I think Phil's growing as a human being.
Okay.
He's listening to reason and pronouncing R's. It's all good.
What a magical day.
I don't know. I mean, he
doesn't know that he's growing as a human being.
Yeah. You can't just. I mean, the guy was flawed for sure. The other frat boys that I've defended were fine. There was
yeah. No all right. Whatever.
Yeah. No issues.
Still wrong.
With the prior ones.
Yeah,
this one. This one here. The only thing that he. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. Anyway, for me, the film was all right. I liked the fourth segment, the best out of all five segments, for sure. As a film compared to other films this year, I don't think it's going to be. It's definitely not as good as films like The Lodge or VFW or 1BR or The Wretched or anything like that. So I don't know if it'll be a film that I'll bring up at the end of the year. I think it'll have some legs because it is being pumped by Shudder right now. And it does have that mortuary dark character that Mike mentioned that will get some interest. It was okay. It was a pretty decent film, but nothing to write home about. Eric.
This movie is plain oatmeal, and I would encourage you to go get some pancakes or maybe some bacon and eggs. Even some Cinnamon Toast Crunch. There are lots of options that are better. So that's how I feel about this.
Or fresh baked child.
Now for breakfast.
And there's nothing wrong.
Any meal of the day.
Nothing wrong with frat boys. Nothing wrong with frat. Anyway, so once again, this is directed by Ryan Spindell. It was an expanded film to go with his babysitter murder short that he got buzzed for in the past. He also wrote this film. Stars Clancy Brown. among other folk, and it is available on Shudder for free if you subscribe to Shudder. And it is getting excellent reviews. I think it has like 31 reviews on Rotten Tomatoes with 97%. So there's just one person that said they didn't like it, I guess. So I guess with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about the Mortuary Collection. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.